SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Greg at 7 o'clock. On this day, back in the 1970s, oil markets would reshape the global economy and permanently changed what we knew as inflation expectations. I think in today's day and age, there are different things shaping those conversations, and we're going to get into some of those factors in today's show. Nevertheless, I'm Jimmy Moyar. This is the SAFM Market Update, and let's get you up to date.
Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Coming up on the show today, we take a look at the latest results from the team at Sasol. They provided us with an update on the first 6 months of their financial year. We're going to speak to the Chief Financial Officer, Walt Bruns, around that performance, get a sense of what it is that they have been contending with. Then we've got a conversation with Dr. Roelof Botha, independent economist, on his thoughts around the fact that the Reserve Bank's Monetary Policy Committee needs to be reworked and expanded from its 5-member current composition to potentially 12 members. We're going to get a sense of what that would look like and why that's being put forward. We also have a conversation with Professor Adrian Saville of the Gordon Institute of Business Sciences around the Trump tariff conversations that have been unfolding over the last couple of days. Then we chat to 91, taking a look at the infrastructure space in South Africa and how it is that we use that space productively ahead of this week's budget speech. Then we wrap up the show with a digital drive conversation, taking a look at telcos. We're going to kick things off, though, as we always do, with a sense of market movements throughout the day. I'm joined on the line by the Chief Investment Officer at Makwe Fund Managers, Makwe Masilela, to take a look at this and see what we make of today's movements. Dr. Masilela, lovely having you on the show as always. Thanks so much for the time. Interesting start to the week from a local front. We're happy with the positive start, I'd imagine. Your thoughts around some of the driving factors that have been boosting local markets, clearly resources coming back to the party, probably off the back of what happened on Friday with the US Supreme Court. But your thoughts on today's market movements?
You know, I think we appreciate this and it's mostly welcome and good evening to you and to the listeners. I mean, to think that for the whole of last week, we were up 1.6%, but just today only, as you said in our intro, we are up nicely 1.6% and mainly at the back of our resources and our industrials. It's only our financials which are flat. But to think about it, you know, if you look into the commodity prices themselves, you know, I mean, silver up almost 5%, gold up almost 3%. It's only copper and platinum and they're not doing that badly. But I think the long and short of this whole thing is that stocks will, if you look into what's happening overseas, stocks are falling and bonds are going up because there's been a renewed anxiety over the impact of AI on company profits. There is this research company which published an article basically detailing a hypothetical scenario on the impact of AI could have on markets and the global economy. And as you said, this whole issue, the lingering tariff uncertainty, and because of the court ruling and also Trump himself saying, come on, I'll put on 15%. I think he said that on Saturday. And European Union, the guys are saying, no, we cannot go ahead like this. Definitely, we have to get some form of certainty. A deal is a deal. I think the long and short of this, the way it will play out, is that there might be countries which are getting some temporary relief, as Trump definitely will continue to seek what we call a sectoral or economic-specific duties to try to rebuild this whole thing about the tariff regime.
Marco, let's take a look at those international markets. You touched on the fact that obviously the sentiment in the market at the moment driving some of those movements. And I want to get your thoughts around perhaps where we look at the AI conversation. What does that then mean for how markets start to price it? We know valuations have been stretched across the board, international markets, local markets. Everybody's been trying to make heads or tails of how it is that we approach equity markets in some respects. And it seems as though the numbers, the fundamentals are starting to really take shape here. Is this affecting perhaps how you're looking at it from an investment manager perspective as well?
Definitely, it does. Remember, before this whole issue about how this will impact what we call traditional economies, markets were starting to make noise about the returns, given the amount of investments that these companies have been making, that when are we going to start seeing the returns? And I think it's also a way of market participants to try to squeeze these guys to say, please do something. We cannot be waiting forever. And now all these investments spent, they are justifying the, what you call it, the valuations. And so far, we don't have anything concrete, Jimmy, to justify all these rich valuations when it comes to that. So it's a question of, at some point, guys have to start reporting differently, starting to show us some signs, you know, when it comes to the return on equity. And then ambiguity over trade policy, unfortunately, dampens sentiments, and mainly towards the U.S. assets, and raise the prospect of market volatility, and that will be across global markets. And market participants are also starting to price in more of a higher risk premium when it comes to U.S. assets.
Mark, let's take a look at the oil price, $72 a barrel, not where we'd like to see it. We have seen kind of the $70 a barrel level almost act as a ceiling going through 2025, markets briefly dipping above that, but not really holding above that. I want to get your thoughts on where we see the oil price at the moment, understanding that OPEC bloc is not going to be too phased about having the oil price this high, but it certainly does become difficult for us as a net importer of oil.
You know, and especially if the rent doesn't also help, then that will be a problem as a net importer. But I think last week's strong rally at some point, you know, we saw for the better part of the trading session, oil being steady because traders started to weigh the prospect of a third round when it comes to the U.S.-Iran nuclear talks and also some fresh uncertainty, as we said, coming from the U.S. trade policy. But now is a different story. It shows that oil continues to go up. I mean, as we're talking now, it's up almost not 7%, and that doesn't look okay for a country like us, which is a net importer. And I think all of us by now, we know that everything that we do is got a component of oil in the form of transport. So that gets to be inflationary in its nature.
Marco, before I let you go, I want to get your thoughts around this week. We are heading into the budget speech that will be tabled on Wednesday by our Minister of Finance. I want to get your thoughts on perhaps whether or not that speech will move markets. We've seen in the past that having three attempts at a budget speech certainly does have an impact on markets. I want to get your thoughts on what you're expecting this year, and are you nervous about what we might hear on Wednesday?
I'm not nervous, and I think we've learned our lesson, and I think the guys by now know each other, how to deal with each other. But if you look into the demand when it comes to our bonds, our weekly auction that we've seen last week, the demand was just so high, I think more than three times. And because people are optimistic that we'll get a good budget, in the sense that we'll continue to show that we are trying to be very disciplined when it comes to spending. We'll be trying to show that what is it we're trying to do to create an environment for businesses to be able to do well. And as a result, then the economy will do well, and then guys will pay more taxes and also hire more people. So we are kind of optimistic. Jimmy, there's something about us. People tend to like us. We always get this second, third, fourth chances. People get irritated for a few minutes, but thereafter they still have this huge belief on us. But I think this time, let us not disappoint and not take advantage and make sure that we deliver something solid.
Hopefully the irritations that certain people are experiencing do eventually wear off. I think it's been longer than a few minutes that President Trump has been irritated with South Africa. But that perhaps is a conversation for another day. Thanks so much to the Chief Investment Officer at Makwe Fund Managers, Makwe Masilela, for joining us to take a look at market movements, some market expectations, and what markets are starting to think about AI.
Meet Tato Mahate, CMO of Coitec, proving that South African tech can take on the world. Tato, why was telecom business the right call for your team?
Bottom line was connectivity and ensuring that we have the right service provider.
With Telkom Business Fiber, Coitec seamlessly connects local innovations with international manufacturing. Get Stream Connect Fiber from just 399 Rand per month. Call 10213 or check telkom.co.za. T's and C's apply. Telkom Business. Possible begins here.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
The time was 7:05 this morning when Sasol Limited released their financial results for the 6 months ended 31 December 2025. The business experiencing some operational challenges and some significant impairments. We're going to be taking a look at this in greater detail with the Chief Financial Officer at Sasol, Walt Bruns. He joins me on the line now to see what we make of the performance. Walt, lovely having you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. A difficult start to the year, but I suppose that is the nature of dealing with environments where you can't control them. How are you feeling as a team at the moment?
Yeah, thanks, Jimmy, and good evening to you and your listeners. Thanks for having me on the show again. Yeah, we don't get to pick the environment that we operate in, but as you say, it's how we respond that's the most important. You know, I think on our side, the key levers that we do control are things like sales volumes, which we saw a nice uptick, 3% up year on year. And then on the cost side, we saw a nice reduction in our cash fixed cost by 2%. Capital was down by more than 40%. And that helped us generate free cash flow for the first time in the first half of a financial year for more than 4 years. So, you know, you've got to take the good with the bad, but we just focused on what we can do and how we respond. And as a team, that's what we committed to.
Walt, let's get into some of the difficulties that you have been experiencing as a business. I suppose most notably there would be almost 8 billion rands worth of non-cash remeasurements in the form of impairments making up the bulk of that. Take us through that as well as some of the other challenges you've had to contend with in this period.
Yeah, so I think the impairments, the two most notable ones were in our Secunda liquid fuels refinery. That cash generating unit remains fully impaired. So the impairment of 3 billion is linked to the capital that we spent in this period. I think what's important for you and your listeners, Jimmy, is that just one view of the Secunda, you know, asset itself. You know, the Secunda also produces chemicals. That's a separate cash generating unit. And there we still see significant headroom above the net book value. So in total, Secunda itself remains very profitable. And then I think the second large impairment is just in Mozambique. It's linked to our PSA project. There, it's not so much the total volumes of gas that's reduced, but just it's a timing lag in terms of those volumes. And that delayed monetization has resulted in an impairment. So we're looking at how do we claw that back. There's some physical constraints with the plant, but we're quite hopeful that we can come up with a non-CapEx or CapEx-light solution and make sure that excess gas comes to South Africa.
Walt, let's take a look at that chemicals business in a bit more detail. I want to particularly look at the offshore business and just the entire chemicals portfolio for Sasol. That has been something that we've discussed on multiple occasions, not just in this catch-up. Where do we stand on that business? How is that doing? Are we seeing signs of recovery? What's the latest there?
Yeah, so I think, we'll start. Our reset strategy is progressing. I mean, the market conditions are weaker than what we anticipated, and we saw some slightly lower US ethylene margins. We did, however, manage to increase our EBITDA by about 10% versus the prior year, and we have, however, adjusted our long-term kind of guidance, not a long-term, our FY26 guidance. So we previously guided we were going to make $450 to $550 million EBITDA. Our latest guidance shows around 375 to 450, so slightly revision, but mostly driven by, you know, lower macro price assumptions, some weaker demand, especially in the European business, and then you know, we had an unplanned outage in the second half of last year at our cracker. So the business, it's a bit mixed. We're seeing improvements across the different areas, but they are not, it's not changing our longer term view of the business. We still think it's value accretive.
Walt, we'll come back to that long term view in a second. I noted that from a cash flow perspective, the business had almost 1 billion rand in free cash flow improvements, significant improvement from that perspective. CapEx was a little lower, but the decision from a business perspective, in line with where the debt sits at the moment, I imagine, is that the dividend will be put on hold for the foreseeable future. Take us through the dividend policy from a company perspective for those that don't know the policy, and perhaps where management sits on when you're likely to see conditions potentially reverse in this area.
Sure. Yeah, we adjusted our dividend policy at our Capital Markets Day in May of last year. So we committed to paying 30% of free cash flow as dividends, but only when the net debt, excluding leases, is sustainably below $3 billion. Currently, we're sitting around $3.8 billion. So we haven't reached that dividend trigger. We still expect to get there in FY28. So that's, you know, 2 years from now. But we think it's the quickest way for us to create value for our equity shareholders is one is to de-risk the enterprise by reducing the debt. And in so doing, as we reduce the debt, we also increase the equity share of the enterprise value. So we feel that it's a quicker way for us to create value for our shareholders. And to be honest, you've seen it in the share price performance over the last year. We've recovered off a pretty low base and we'll continue to deliver that uplift in the equity value. Obviously, the macros remain uncertain and volatile, and it's never easy to predict what the oil price or exchange rate is going to do. But I think that comes back, Jimmy, to my comments earlier, is how we respond, is how we will it will define us.
Well, speaking of that response, let's get to that outlook. How are you and the team looking at the next 6 months, potentially even the next 12 to 18 months from a strategy point of view? I see there is still a sense of optimism. The business still has quite a bit of liquidity headroom. You are still in the positions to make certain strategic decisions. What does that strategy start to look like with earnings down for the first 6 months, impairments up, and the challenge that lies ahead for the business?
Yeah, so I think, I mean, we'll continue to, as I mentioned earlier, on the self-help measures that I've explained. I think, you know, we don't get to dictate what the oil price or exchange rate is going to do. But I think, you know, continuing to produce and sell volumes that customers still want and need, doing it in a cost competitive way, you'll see our break-even oil price has come down. It's now $53 a barrel for the first half. And then on our international chemical business, continue with that reset strategy. You know, it's maybe slower than what we would have liked, but it's certainly still delivering incremental gains. And we still think there's quite a bit of potential for us to unlock. So, you know, Jimmy, it's about doing the basics right, keeping our costs low, making sure our capital is disciplined. And as I mentioned, that will, you know, our primary focus right now is deleveraging that balance sheet and just reducing some of the risk associated with our enterprise.
Keeping the basics in check and making sure that you're able to control the areas of the business that are within your control. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Thanks so much to the Chief Financial Officer at Sasol Limited, Walt Bruns, for taking us through their first 6 months of the year and how their second 6 months could potentially shape up.
In farming, success rarely happens by chance. But when I look ahead and surround myself with the right expertise, I feel confident in my ability to succeed.
At Omnia, we're not just a fertilizer supplier. With a holistic approach built on science, data-driven insights, and experience, we support you throughout the entire season. Your harvest is our greatest achievement.
When I partner with Omnia, I can grow with confidence.
Contact Omnia today and start growing your future.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
We have been going through quite an interesting rate cycle with the South African Reserve Bank, and we are expecting to see rate cuts going into the rest of this year. But amidst all of this, there is quite an interesting paper that's been drafted by a number of independent economists that suggests that perhaps the South African Reserve Bank's restrictive monetary policy is something that could be contributing towards our low growth and the erosion of real value in terms of households. For more on this, I'm joined on the line by one of the independent economists that was part of co-authoring this paper. That is Dr. Roelof Botha, to take a look at his thoughts and get a sense of where we go to from here. Dr. Botha, lovely having you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. Certainly an interesting viewpoint on the Monetary Policy Committee. Can you give us a sense perhaps of what brought the paper about, but more importantly, why you hold this view?
Well, if you deal with macroeconomics as I have for the last 5 decades, then you pick up trends, I believe, a little bit quicker. And what me and some of my colleagues noticed is that there was a huge increase, a huge change, a decisive shift in the conduct of monetary policy since the departure of the previous governor, Jill Marcus. Ever since her retirement, the balanced approach towards the level of short-term interest rates, which is, to my mind, and I think most economists would agree with me, the most important single economic indicator in this country, because it affects directly and indirectly the spending power of businesses and individuals. And there has been a decisive shift. Just to give you an idea, the average real prime rate, prime minus CPI, was 3.1% in 2014 when Jill Marcus was around. Shortly after her retirement, it went to an average of 5.1% in 2017, after the new MPC was appointed by Mr. Jacob Zuma, the state capturer par excellence. Then it went to 6% in 2019 and 8.3% real prime rate in March 2025. It was, I think, the third highest in the world. It was the highest level in 15 years, despite an absence of any sign of demand inflation. And this bothered us, that why had there been such a decisive shift in monetary policy when what went hand in hand with this decisive shift, of course, was a huge increase in unemployment. This country's problem is not high inflation. It has not been a problem. High inflation has not been a problem for the last two decades. Our problem is high unemployment. You do not create jobs if you have the highest interest rate in the world.
Dr. Botha, how then do we approach this situation? I mean, there's a recommendation and a suggestion that the Monetary Policy Committee in its structure at the moment be looked at and reviewed. What would that serve to achieve?
Well, I'll answer that in a second. But I just want to make one point, you know, clear. You know, the rate increase we had of 475 basis points in the prime rate via the repo between shortly after COVID and until they took this to a record in 2025, 2024, that if you apply that 475 basis points to total mortgage advances of South African banks of just below 2 trillion rand, it means that their additional debt cost burden was 91 billion rand. That money could have been spent in the economy. And I can almost guarantee you that our unemployment rate would have been lower. But what we realize is that these five or six, it's fascinating I try to get the exact number from the Reserve Bank's publications, and they're not sure themselves. They say there's five members, but it can be seven. Now, I'm not sure to what extent they can co-opt people, but these are political appointments. And the question arises, do these five people really have what it takes? Do they understand business? Do they understand the demographics of South Africa? Do they have what it takes to take a decision on the most important indicator in the economy, which affects 62 million people? And our answer to that question was, no, they don't. It would be to our advantage if one were to a more democratic approach towards monetary policy in this country by having inputs. And our suggestion was that you have obviously two people from the Reserve Bank, unfortunately, I have to add, but that would be necessary. Then two people from National Treasury, probably the Director General and the Chief Economist. And then you go to the relevant parliamentary standing committees, two nominees from there, two nominees from the financial services sector. It could be the Bankers Association of South Africa. Some of the large banks could maybe, you know, take turns in nominating people. And then two people from employed organizations like Business Unity South Africa or Consulting Engineers South Africa. And then two people from the trade union environment, from the key trade union in South Africa. You have 12 members now of the Monetary Policy Committee. Each has the same waiting for a vote after their meetings. And the meetings do not have to be every second month. The meetings should only occur when it's necessary, when you see that we are not creating jobs at a fast enough pace. Then they should meet and have a look at what are the reasons. If one of the reasons is the fact that the cost of credit and the cost of capital is too high, then lower the interest rate. It's as easy as that.
Dr. Botha, alongside the conversations around potentially re-looking at the composition of the Monetary Policy Committee, do you believe we should be re-looking at their mandate as well as a central bank in terms of how it is that they would then be contributing towards the economy? Understanding, of course, that those challenges that you outlined are challenges we've had to contend with for quite some time as a country.
Yes. I mean, the mission of the Reserve Bank should remain intact. The dilemma that many economists in this country have been facing is the fact that they are interpreting their mandate and their mission statement only halfway. It says they only stick to trying to maintain price stability, but it goes further than that. And my friend from Investec, a well-known economist, has said on many occasions that it seems as if they're Ryan Cantor, as if they are forgetting about the second part. The second part, they must also conduct monetary policy in such a way that they further this country's growth and employment creation prospects. It is as if they have just erased that part. And that is really very frustrating. It's right for them to argue that, yes, but there are structural problems in the economy, you know, infrastructure, we haven't built enough, we're not repairing fast enough. The point is just that if they could lower rates, we will have more capital formation, we will have more private sector consumption expenditure, business formation, we will have a broader tax base. Because for every job that you create, you broaden the tax base. And then with a new approach towards public-private partnerships, maybe we can really get cracking on the structural side of things. But it doesn't help you if you've got these structural problems and you also have one of the highest cost of capital in the world.
A proposal for an expanded monetary policy committee could potentially be the difference maker in reigniting South Africa's economy if we are to look at it from that perspective. That is certainly the view of a paper that has been authored by some leading independent economists in South Africa, one of which just joined us on the line to discuss this. Dr. Roelof Botha, thanks so much for the time and for the insights. Dr. Roelof Botha joining us to take a look at whether or not we should be rethinking our monetary policy committee.
For Onwetu Nxumalo of Ozide Rentals and Custom Dressmaking, every stage is a story. What's your Telkom business chapter?
What made Telkom business stand out from all the rest was how fast everything was.
And with voice calling and fiber from Telkom business, she stitches together inquiries and sources fabric online without dropping a thread.
Get unlimited VoIP 1 from 99 Rand per month and stream Connect Fiber from 399 Rand per month. Call 10213 or click telkom.co.za. T's and C's apply. Telkom business. Possible begins.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
So late on Friday, the US Supreme Court ruled that the tariffs imposed by President Trump on almost all countries around the world was an overreach on the part of the president. In response to this, President Trump then came out to impose new tariffs on the world. We're going to look at this. We're going to try and make sense of it with Professor for Economics, Finance and Strategy at the Gordon Institute of Business Sciences, Professor Adrian Saville. He joins me on the line now to see what we make of this. Prof, lovely having you on the show as always. It seems our conversations become more and more colourful each time we catch up. I can't help but wonder whether or not this is less about tariffs and more about potentially a tantrum. What do you make of these developments?
Yeah, indeed, Jimmy. I'd put colourful is certainly belongs in the sentence. I think if we get sort of out of the noise of the Friday to Monday narrative and just sort of try and step back and get a bit of perspective on the broader trajectory, I think you know what this really highlights is the that power is being balanced. And that it is being distributed between executive power, which is where the tariffs have come from, and institutional constraint or institutional guardrails. And in any economy, you need those checks and balances so that you can negotiate what we could refer to, borrowing from Darren Acemoglu and James Robertson, as we can navigate or negotiate the narrow corridor. Because executive power and authority is necessary to get stuff done, but institutional constraints and guardrails, barriers, boundaries are necessary to keep that power in check. And so I think that's what you're seeing going on here, is this trade-off. And what the institutional constraints, i.e. what the Supreme Court ruling does, is it slows trade policy down. It obliges trade policy to be more, what are the right words here, sort of deliberate and predictable. And that is good for capital allocation. That's good for growth. That's good for markets.
Prof, when we look at trade policy, particularly in the context of the United States, can we make sense of what the United States' priorities are? I bring this up because I see a tweet from the new ambassador from the United States to South Africa suggesting that they that he had a the opportunity to present a copy of his letters of credence to the Department of International Relations and Cooperation. And the ambassador says, and I quote, "I look forward to advancing U.S. priorities to build a safer, stronger, and more prosperous America, grounded in American exceptionalism and shared opportunity." But this is supposedly an opportunity to strengthen relationships between the United States and South Africa in the form of a partnership. Doesn't sound like this is a partnership, does it?
Well, you know, if you look at the ground that we've covered, and the amplitudes, the peaks and the troughs that we've had over the course of the last 12, 13 months when it comes to tariffs, I think it is hard to separate, you know, the wood from for the trees. But, you know, again, you know, let's just step back and, you know, why I'm banging on about this point about stepping back is because we've had such fast switches in direction of travel that you've got whiplash. And, you know, in whiplash, it's not easy to make decisions. So, you know, let's try and just step back. And here I'll put three big strands that we can weave through the noise and the disturbances and the utterances of the current administration. The first is there is a very deliberate and determined effort to strengthen the U.S. domestic industrial policy, reshoring, building strength in specific sectors. So that's hard to mistake. It's very clear what that is about. The second is there is a direct voice around geopolitical positioning, especially with regard to China. And there has been consistency in that. And then the third is around supply chain security. Now, it's South Africa's business, and here I want to underline this in turn. It's South Africa's business to step out of the noise and to be strategic. And we don't have the power or the capacity to call the shots here. So now let's go to what Mark Carney calls the, you know, the middle-sized powers. And where do we find our footing as a middle-sized power with the business of U.S. domestic industrial policy reshoring, with the fracturing and fragmentation geopolitically, and how do we secure a space in global supply chains? So I think that that is the call to business for South Africa from a policy and a business perspective.
Prof, I want to get your thoughts on whether or not we're in for more whiplash, understanding that President Trump didn't hesitate.
You don't even have to finish your you didn't have to finish your sentence. Come on, Jimmy.
This is very obvious. This is, I've got neck pain just thinking about it. So this is not the end of the road from a policy perspective and a decision perspective.
No, and having cut you short, I'm not sure you'll have me back on the show in a hurry, but in having cut you short, of course there will be more whiplashing. You know, here I want to do the however is think about, you know, where we were 12, 13 months ago, and it was, wow, you know, this is going to be dramatic. And what's actually come to pass has been far less dramatic. There was some fiscal firepower thrown into the cocktail. Monetary firepower was thrown into the cocktail. Business and supply chains have shown themselves all to be far more agile than we imagined. So now I think it would be disingenuous for me to say, oh, and look, you know, there's a double whammy on the table because that nasty tariff thing isn't going to happen. In fact, you know, we've consumed the absorption, but, you know, like, well done to us on navigating without compromising growth, looking after our trade patterns, and in fact, coming out with, I think, a better story to tell than we went in. So for South Africa, the specific implications are, you know, how do we play on commodity strength? How do we use our resource-based materials channels? How do we double down on the industrial, intermediate industrial goods that we do have to offer? And all of that said, we will get more whiplashing. And so now that, you know, the next point would be back to my earlier case, as a mid-sized power, how do we strategically position ourselves with the US and with others? We aren't a country that has the luxury of choice here. We have to figure out how to work our way with multiple partners and to be strategically promiscuous.
Prof, before I let you go, when we look at emerging markets and where South Africa sits in that basket, do we have perhaps a strategic advantage in that we have been able to weather some of these storms potentially better than other emerging market economies?
I think so. And, you know, Jimmy, some of it's been given to us rather than our own creation, and specifically an emerging market currency that is well-traded, well-managed, listening to you talk to Roelof, you know, about South African Reserve Bank. So we do have real industrial heft, and that is translated into rand strength. We should make hay with that sun shining, because it will translate into lower inflation. We've got monetary policy levers that we could pull there. The second is commodity prices and gold specifically. That is going to be a bonanza. You've got a budget coming shortly, so we've got a windfall gain from commodity prices. Don't squander this. The last time we had this commodity price windfall, we ripped through the money and there's nothing to show for it. And then, you know, the third is just to think about, you know, where we are strategically strong. And I might have overplayed the mid-sized power that we don't have too much strength, but we do have specific strategic strengths. And I would, you know, mention specifically regionalization, where South Africa remains the most sophisticated competitive economy from a regional perspective. And then to think about strategic diversification. Who else can we do business with, not at the expense of, but in combination with?
The whiplash is inevitable, but South Africa can remain focused on its own objectives and its own strategy if we are to weather the storm. Of course, we do still have more than 1,000 days, if I'm not mistaken, of the Donald Trump administration to deal with. So we have to strap in and get everything or keep everything going as planned. We'll leave this conversation, though, on that note. Thanks so much to Professor Adrian Saville of the Gordon Institute of Business Sciences, joining us to unpack the latest developments in Trump tariffs.
There are plenty of people who want to invest in the stock market but don't, because they believe it's only for the rich. Well, now you can buy some of the best performing investments in the world, even if all you have is 1 rand. That's right, 1 rand. I'm talking to Connie Bloom, CEO of a digital assets trading platform built on the blockchain, and the company's called Mesh Trade, to talk about what the future of investing looks like. And as we find out, it's definitely not just for the rich. Don't forget, join me, Kieron Ryan, weekly on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast. Listen on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify.
MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
This investment feature is brought to you by 91, investing for a world of change. Speak to your financial advisor or visit 91.com to invest in your financial future. So we are a couple of hours away from the 2026 budget speech that will be tabled by our Minister of Finance. And ahead of that, we know that some conversations are going to be top of mind, one of which is likely to be infrastructure development and infrastructure investment. We're going to be taking a look at this in a bit more detail with the Managing Director for Emerging Markets Alternative Credit at 91, Alistair Herbertson. He joins me on the line now to see what we can expect or what we hope to here come Wednesday. Alistair, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Perhaps let's start the conversation with the importance of hearing the infrastructure conversations come the budget speech on Wednesday. Where do we stand in terms of a wish list and some real tangible deliverables where it relates to infrastructure?
I think we've seen a lot of discussion in public spheres regarding infrastructure investments and using infrastructure to trigger jobs in the economy. I think that what we're really looking forward in this budget is to see some credible spending plans, identifying where capital is going to go and understanding how it's going to actually be invested rather than broad brush promises and aspirational statements.
Alistair, we've heard from various individuals, including the Minister of Public Works, that they would like to turn South Africa into a construction site. We've heard on many occasions the President of South Africa saying that the importance of infrastructure cannot be understated. If this is to be the backbone of growth and jobs within the South African context, what then do we need to be focusing on from a budget perspective, understanding that that budget conversation is going to drive the capital allocation conversation?
So there's obviously the budget speech, which will identify the priorities. But what we'll be also looking for is the actual allocations within the tables and the annexures to the budget, and actually seeing how the capital will reach the points that it is needed. So investing in infrastructure requires both provincial, national, provincial and local governments, as well as the SOEs, to work in cohort. There's nothing worse than bottlenecking. In other words, finding an investment, building a new road, and then not being able to get on and off of it because the roads at each end are congested. So what we're really looking for is a coherence of the strategy, bringing together the spending in ways that will not just bring capital, but capital in a way that will lead to productive growth.
Alistair, you speak of bottlenecks, and I want to get your thoughts around some of the challenges that still persist within the infrastructure environment. We have managed to get things like load shedding under control compared to what we've had in the past, but areas like our ports, our rails, and most recently water infrastructure seem to be facing some significant challenges. What does that then do from an investor risk perspective when they're looking at infrastructure investment and seeing all of these risks?
I think that we are seeing an evolution in the infrastructure space regarding the capital allocation. So whether that's the water, the logistics, the energy or electricity, you know, and human capital too. I think that we've got to separate out what is politically imperative, which is obviously things like electricity, which affects individuals, and water, where it's very apparent to the voting population, versus what sometimes is hidden from the consumer's eye, which is, you know, the tariffs that get lumped on top of it, the goods that we buy and we sell and we export. So I think, in my view, in the next 1 to 2 years, the area of critical importance is going to be the logistics sector, getting the freight and the goods that are being imported and exported efficiently to the right place, exported through the ports into the global market, and vice versa, bringing in the components that we require to do that, or that our consumers wish to purchase. So I think we'll be seeing a lot of attention to the logistics. Unfortunately, it probably doesn't carry the same political weight that a water failure would. Water is critically important, but it takes decades to solve and to plan for. So I think we're seeing a lot of work in the water sector, but I do think the critical place of attention needs to be in the logistics and transport sector.
Now, Alistair, we've been able to get something uniquely right in South Africa over, I'd say, the last 12 months, maybe a little longer than that, and that is a good understanding of the importance of public and private collaborations and partnerships. How then do we continue to approach that from an infrastructure point of view, understanding that a lot of the public side of it sits in what is announced on Wednesday in the budget speech and how we unlock the markets and how we unlock the red tape? But from a private perspective as well, we still need to keep in mind that we need to make infrastructure investable. How do we find that balance, understanding that this could potentially be a catalyst to a whole different South African economy?
I think that the South African government for many years and has looked at a lot of different solutions. And each time, I think different solutions lend themselves better to different infrastructure investments and different challenges that are encompassed. So I do think that the South African government has for many years looked at working as effectively as they can with the private sector, because ultimately, you know, the public sector and the private sector operate in different ways and they have different objectives and goals and they have different strengths and skills. So to me, it's been something that's been around and we expect to see more of it. I will obviously be looking to see how the government wishes to divide and split and allocate the risks and the rewards associated with investing in this infrastructure. But I do think that we expect to see more of that in this budget speech.
Infrastructure investment, one of the focal points of the 2026 budget speech. It's been focal point of many a speech, but this time around we're looking to see if this can be a delivery budget rather than a promissory budget. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Thanks so much to the Managing Director for Emerging Markets Alternative Credit at 91, Alistair Herbertson, for joining us to share his thoughts on how it is, on what it is he's looking forward to in Wednesday's budget speech that relates to infrastructure. This feature was brought to you by 91, investing for a world of change. Speak to your financial advisor or visit 91.com to invest in your financial future.
Change is an unannounced visitor. It can derail you or delight you. Hello? It's pushy, inescapable, intriguing. Change is motivating. Change is action. Change has places for you to be. Change is opportunity. We always have our door open to it. For over 3 decades, we've been committed to seeking out the best investment opportunities for you, wherever they may be. 91. Investing for a world of change. 91 is an authorized FSP.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It's Digital Drive time, and we're going to be taking a look at something different for this week's Digital Drive. We're going to be looking at the telecoms space, but we're not going to be focusing on the largest telecoms players. Rather, we're going to be looking at some of the other telcos in South Africa and taking a look at perhaps what it is that they offer the market. I'm specifically referring to the likes of Telkom and Cell C. I'm joined on the line by fund manager at Anchor Capital, Mike Gresty, to take a look at this and see what to make of it. Mike, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Your thoughts on the telco space? It is arguably one of the most competitive spaces, and I know various people hold the view that perhaps we even have too many telcos in South Africa. Your thoughts on the space at the moment?
Yeah, good evening, Jimmy, and thank you for having me. I think you've summed it up well, saying, you know, how competitive it is. It's been an extremely penetrated sector for a long time, and I continue to be amazed at how, despite that, you see sort of the growth we're seeing in telecom and the changing dynamics, certainly with Cell C now regaining its mojo, I guess you could say. So it's a very interesting space, I suppose, after a period when it's been very much a two-horse race. We're seeing some quite interesting developments from the smaller players now.
Mike, let's look in on those smaller players in a bit more detail. The bigger players have decided that they've got enough of the South African market that they would like to focus their efforts on African markets. And so it leaves us really with South Africans being spoiled for choice locally. If you are in that space and you are perhaps the players 3 and 4, how do you then position your value proposition to a South African consumer that really has all the choice that they need?
Yeah, absolutely. It is certainly a consumer choice market at the moment. What has been really interesting is how Telkom and, you know, increasingly now Cell C are differentiating themselves. So, you know, in the case of Telkom, I think they've done a fantastic job, perhaps benefiting from the fact that they don't have the legacy voice business to worry about. So, you know, they really have come into the market with a data-first strategy and offered really quite simple products that the market understands and have resonated with the market. They've executed very well around their own network strategy, and perhaps we can chat to that a little bit just now. And then in the case of Cell C, I'm going to be interested to see in time how the market responds to the fact that they roam on MTN and Vodacom's network and claim, and I can't fault them on this, that really you get the best of both worlds in terms of network coverage and quality of network. And I think that's going to be quite a powerful message that they're going to be pushing with the market in the months ahead.
Mike, let's look at that strategy in a bit more detail. What does your differentiating strategy then become as a telco if you are looking to increase your market share, if you are looking to continuously grow your reach within whatever market you operate in? I mean, we've seen, as you've rightly alluded to, different strategies by Telkom and Cell C, and I think back to Telkom's decision to sell off their infrastructure assets, whereas the likes of MTN have just taken a decision to buy back infrastructure assets they used to own. What then becomes the winning strategy, if there is one, or is it more around perhaps defining what part of the market or area of the market you wish to dominate?
Yeah, I mean, each management team are fiercely promoting their particular strategy. I'm always reticent to suggest that, you know, the very asset-light model that Cell C is pushing, where, you know, they don't own any network and are essentially an MVNO roaming on both MTN and Vodacom's network, you know, extremely compelling from a returns on capital perspective. But, you know, at the end of the day, I can't get away from the fact in my own mind that if you own your own network, you have the lowest cost of production, and it's hard to get away from that. So, you know, in the case of Cell C, I think they have a very good symbiotic relationship with the mobile operators. That wholesale revenue that they pay MTN and Vodacom is incredibly important to them. You know, keep in mind that MTN and Vodacom's network has to be running full tilt all the time, even if it's not being used. So having a Cell C buying capacity from you is very important in terms of their model. But how do they differentiate? I think it's a lot around, you know, how they've then onsold to the likes of Mr. Price, Capitec, who are able to use essentially their mobile offering perhaps as an addition and, you know, not necessarily a profit center within their own businesses. So it's interesting. They're all finding niches. But I think what I do want to stress is one has to be careful of not creating a situation in the market where there is no incentive for anybody to invest in network. You know, that would be a situation that would really, really worry me, because ultimately the consumer suffers. So, you know, this is something that's going to need to be regulated carefully. You know, there's a lot of competition for capital, and you made the point earlier on that MTN and Vodacom are increasingly focusing on the rest of Africa, where I think the regulators are becoming a lot more clear in their minds about the importance of making sure that there's incentive to invest in network. And that's something SA is going to need to be careful of. And I just need to stress that.
Mike, let's wrap up the conversation on that network topic, because that's been quite the contentious topic around the fact that we need to increase more of the infrastructure to increase accessibility, and conversations around the likes of Starlink and other satellite providers coming into the space have sparked quite a bit of debate. If we are looking at the infrastructure environment or the digital environment in South Africa, where do we need to be focusing from strengthening perspective if we are looking at that network? Do we need to be building more? Do we need to be allowing access to players that have got the capital spend? How do we grow that digital footprint?
So, Jimmy, what I think it requires is, you know, quite forward thinking around areas like network sharing. It's completely suboptimal, you know, for four players, or shall we say three players, to be overbuilding one another. So, you know, I think it's responsible regulation around that. It's being open-minded and understanding the importance of allowing telcos to generate acceptable returns on capital. Increasingly in other markets, you're seeing price floors being put in place. You know, I've had the sense that historically South Africa has tended to be very much the champion of the consumer, which can be a double-edged sword. So, you know, I think it's looking at models and regulatory environments shifting and recognizing the importance of, you know, following best in breed out there, and possibly a need to shift away from the traditional focus on competition at all cost.
The telecom space certainly is gearing up to get even more competitive than it currently already is, and hopefully that is all to the benefit of South African consumers. We're going to leave that conversation on that note. Thanks so much to fund manager at Anchor Capital, Mike Gresty, for joining us to take a look at the telecom space in South Africa.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
And that's the update for today, folks. If you've missed any of the conversations, they'll be uploaded as podcasts, of course, this week as we build up to the budget. We'll be bringing you some budget build up tomorrow to take a look at what we can expect on Wednesday. But for now, it is coming up to 7 o'clock, which means Greg Hose is standing by with the latest round of evening news, followed by Michael Abramson and the top sport team. So from my side, good night.